The Tom Woods Show, episode 1987.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, it does not matter where we are in the school year, it is never too late to join the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, which will give your kids an unfair advantage and which features 400 videos on history taught by me. And if you do decide to join the curriculum, of course, join through my link, because through my link only will you get $160 worth of free bonuses. So check out my link, ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I am so glad to be joined by the returning hero, Scott Horton, today. Scott, of course, as you know, is our great foreign policy expert. He is the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director at antiwar.com. He is the host of The Scott Horton Show. Check him out at scotthorton.org. And he has just completed his long-awaited and delayed by COVID debate with the very, very prominent, well-known neoconservative Bill Kristol, former editor of The Weekly Standard. He may have founded that magazine, for all I know. But anyway, we're going to have Scott fill in the details about Kristol. But the guy is just everywhere in print and throughout the media. And he is known for his extreme hawkishness. So here was an opportunity for a hardcore libertarian to go up against him. And it was just a brutal beatdown. Brutal. So I hope you guys will watch it. I'll put the video up on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1987. Scott, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom.
Oh my gosh, did I enjoy watching this thing. Now, I finally did watch the whole thing because there's a bootleg version that's out there until the Soho Forum gets the official version out. There's no stopping people who want to watch this thing. So it was going to be out there one way or another. But I had the live stream on, but I'm also, you know, I get kids and that time of day, you know, it's days coming to an end and dinner is over and it's kind of hectic.
First things first, man.
Yeah, but oh gosh, did I want to just say, listen, guys, I spend a whole lot of time with you. I'm a really devoted father, but I just need this little bit of time. But it's okay. I mean, I got your whole opening statement. I missed his, but I got yours. And then the rebuttal was great. And the Q&A, oh my gosh. Anyway, so I was just cheering. And my kids, one by one, they were walking by saying, oh, what's this? And I said, oh, this is actually going on live right now. This is our friend Scott Horton. You've heard me talk to him in the car and blah, 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 blah. And then little Sarah came in. She's seven. She wanted to know what was going on. So I just explained that this guy right here is a hero and he's fighting against this bad guy. And like that was the level I kept it at. So first of all, tell people so they get the significance of this, because there will be 15% of the listeners who don't even know who Bill Kristol is. What's the significance of Bill Kristol?
Well, first of all, thank you. You're way too kind and you're so lucky you have so many daughters, dude. You must be so happy all the time.
Thank you.
That's awesome. Listen, so Bill Kristol was the editor of the Weekly Standard. Right now, he's probably most famous for being an anti-Trump conservative and, in fact, someone who is so disgusted with Trump in so many ways, some of which we might agree with or not. He really has moved, I think, to the Democratic Party. I think I had read that he quit the Republican Party over
that's for
Trump,
sure,
and is now seen by like the very worst center-left liberal Democrat types as this great hero, right, for being a turncoat to their side. And he's great. And if they knew anything about his role in the Bush years, then they forgot it, or they decided to forget it because, you know, he's so caustic against the new nationalist right and all that. But he's the one who ruined everything. And that was what my statement was in there, was there's so many things about his version of what's going wrong in America now that are his fault, literally, as the leader of the neoconservative movement that pushed us into Iraq War II. Raimondo called it, Justin Raimondo from antiwar.com, called it the Axis of Kristol. Ooh, because he was good. The guy who had 15 sheets of paper in his desk drawer, each one of which was a different think tank incorporated, and would, you know, have all these guys, you know, write up all these papers to recommend war with Iraq. And of course, most famously, the Project for a New American Century, but there are others as well. And then he was the editor of the Weekly Standard, which already was, you know, like the number two most important conservative magazine at the time. And this is when magazines really mattered a lot more than they do 20 years later now, if people want to remember back about that. You know, there's the National Review and then there's the Weekly Standard. And they're extremely important as the Wall Street Journal or something like that in American culture in terms of political culture. And Dick Cheney famously had the Weekly Standard delivered in bulk to everybody in the White House and all over Congress and everywhere whenever they were in power. And these were the guys who pushed us into war. They're the ones who lied us into war.
And Crystal was just all over TV, all over TV. And it didn't matter if things he said failed to come true. They kept having him on. As we've seen on a number of issues, it doesn't matter how wrong you are. If you serve the regime's interest, you just keep getting invited back.
Right.
And I think you were a real sport, by the way, in this debate, because you could have spent some time reviewing his botched predictions. You know, I mean, there is
right.
a whole bunch of
them. There's just no time for it. You know, that. I mean, if I'd had half an hour to give a talk about it. Well, and look, Gene reminded me. I saw Gene at Freedom Fest. And Gene told me.
And we're talking about Gene Epstein, the moderator.
Yes, sir. The Mr. Soho Forum. Very kind gentleman. And yes. And he said, listen, Scott, remember, the question is regime change good for America or is it not? Okay. So obviously, you know, it's not like Crystal's role in this is off limits or anything, but that's not the topic of the debate. So don't get lost
point.
In that.
Good point.
I could attack him over all kinds of things forever. And, you know, one of the things I would have loved to be able to put in parentheses in there was about his support for the surge in Afghanistan. Halfway through the Afghan war, they tripled it and then they lost anyway. And he said in the Weekly Standard, all hail Obama.
I remember
escalating that,
that
war.
Yeah.
That was what made a Democrat a good Democrat. That's how you get the praise of Bill Kristol and the neoconservatives is to be bad on war. And, you know, of course, the rest of the media, you know, they really follow this guy's lead a lot. And I got to say, Tom, I was a bit surprised at what a lightweight he was. I mean, I've heard him talk before. I know what he's about. And I knew he was going to say the world's been at peace for 75 years and all these things, you know. But it seemed like that was really all he had was kind of some leftover talking points and slogans. And he didn't really want to engage with me on the subject matter at all. And I was kind of surprised about that. Like, in fact, at one point, and I'm sorry, because I actually only watched the thing a little bit myself on the plane on the way home. And I was fast forwarding through some things because we're like coming up on landing and I wanted to see the end. But if I remember right, he not only claimed to be anti-war by the end, which talk about winning a debate about against Bill Kristol. Jesus Christ.
I know it.
But I think he even said that, yeah, we shouldn't have done Iraq War II. I think he said, like, we probably shouldn't have done it, which is just absolutely incredible.
Yeah, he also said if we had known there weren't any weapons of mass destruction, we wouldn't have gone in.
Well, but that's different because he still chalked that up to a mistake. And I made sure to mention that his magazine led the way in lying about Saddam's connection
yes,
to Al-Qaeda.
Correct. Yes, right.
That.
That Saddam's going to give the weapons
claim,
to Osama.
Well, the CIA said, Tom, I was just, you know, but I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's the old story of Saddam is going to give the weapons to Osama unless we stop him immediately. That whole thing.
Right. Exactly and right.
That sounded dumb, even if you didn't know anything about anything. That sounded like they're just trying to come up with something. I mean, that did not sound like they've studied this deeply.
Yeah, unless you believed it, which a lot of people did, right?
Yeah, they believed it because people like this made it up.
Look, man, I got to say, I mentioned this in a speech I gave at a Ron Paul thing one time a long time ago, one of them birthday parties a couple years ago. And I really think that this is true because I remember it, that I think a lot of the culture war, I mean, we had a culture war in the 90s. I ain't stupid. I was younger, but yeah. But man, in the W. Bush years, you had half the population said, I can't believe that you people, you disgusting America-hating liberals, you wimps, you're pathetic. You wouldn't support a war to defend this country against Iraq that attacked us and knocked our towers down and killed 3,000 people. And then the other half of the country was screaming, no, you idiot, Saddam didn't do that. And they were saying, no, yeah, he did too, commie, or else how come we're attacking him then? And yet people's families were destroyed over this. People's communities were destroyed over this. A year into the war, it was revealed that they've been torturing people by the thousands. And the first reaction on talk radio was, hey, we don't torture people, man. Constitution, rule of law, Western civilization, this isn't our thing. But then Bush said, hey, we don't torture. But yeah, you're right. We sure do beat the hell out of our captives, all right, to make them talk because we need to. And yeah, we do torture, right? So the conservative right lined up with that, right? Which meant the daughters of all those fools said, screw you, Dad, for being so horrible. And they had giant screaming fights. And some of them never talked to each other again, right? And the entire left and right division in America, culturally speaking, South Park, I mentioned this over and over again. South Park, I believe, Tom, at the time, like in the run-up to the war, their episode about should we attack Iraq or not, Saddam wasn't even in it, I don't think, or maybe just had a bit part. And, you know, Saddam's a regular recurring character on South Park, or was back then. But it wasn't about Iraq. It was about whether you are country or rock and roll. And if you're country, then we're going to go and kick them Iraqis' ass. And if you're rock and roll, then, oh, George Bush is the greedy oil guy and it's all bad. And then that was just the divide, was just whose side are you on here? And I really think that people, I won't say that was the beginning of anything, but I, you know, the way I look at it, I think the division between the left and the right, broadly speaking, in America was really ratcheted up by such a significant degree because the Republicans, led by the neoconservatives, demanded that these essentially innocent bystanders believe their lies and support their violence and called it America and called it red, white, and blue and patriotism and love for your country. And everybody who doesn't support it is an America-hating commie, pinko homo, and damn them. And you're damn right we torture people. And they made the right worse. Oh, and the Muslims. Oh, they're out to get us, the Muslims. And isn't it funny, Tom? Remember, they only dropped that at the end of Obama. They had dropped that like in the first year of Trump. It became Russia, Russia, Russia instead. But from 20 years ago all the way through the beginning of Trump, it was radical Islam. Oh, led by him, by the way, at the very tail end. Radical Islam, radical Islam. And what distinguishes a radical Muslim from the other kind? I mean, they would never even say, right? But it might be all 3 or 4 or 5 million Muslims in America right now. They might be the enemy. What's stopping them from following their religion, which says that they have to hate us and kill us? And they push this so much. And man, and listen, Eli Clifton and Max Blumenthal are two of the best journalists on this issue. And they're both, you know, leftist Jews, by the way, who did in-depth studies about the origins of all of this. And it was the neocons. It's not right-wing rednecks coming up with this stuff. It's Frank Gaffney and Rabbi Shmuley, whatever the hell, I forgot, from Brooklyn. Right? They put all this money into this propaganda campaign to pretend that, oh, they're building a mosque near the old World Trade Center site, a Sufi mosque in a building a few blocks away. No, see, this is radical Islam's triumph over America. What? They passed in many states, I don't know how many, they passed laws to protect everybody from Sharia law being implemented and forcing us to all turn into Muslims, Tom. But that never happened. There was no threat. It's like, you know, Homer Simpson's bear repellent. There's no bears. This is, it's all a propaganda campaign because Frank Gaffney thinks you're stupid and wants to make you afraid of people that he hates and wants to kill. And Frank Gaffney and Bill Kristol and these guys, it's a very small group, you know, all in the neocon family, as Jim Loeb said. You know, when I talked about the coup in Ukraine, that was Bill Kristol's partner, Robert Kagan's wife, that did that. You know, it's very small. And Fred, his brother Fred, was the guy who led the campaign for the surge in Iraq and Afghanistan. So Kagan's brother Fred, not Kristol's. But anyway, so yeah, I mean, these guys, this is the war party, as Justin used to call them. And they are, you know, they're the vanguard of the Zionist movement in America is what they are. And, you know, they're here, as William Kristol said, Bill Kristol's father said, we have to keep America engaged. In fact, the way he said it was, and this is a very like Irving Kristol thing to say, the way he said it was that, and I'm sure you know a hell of a lot more about Irving Kristol than I do, Tom, now that I think about it. But he said that, listen, Jews, meaning liberal democratic Jewish voters in America, they don't like big defense budgets, right? They're not Reaganites. They don't want a big arms buildup and all of this stuff. But by whatever means, we have to keep them convinced to support American engagement with the rest of the world, prevent any kind of retreat to isolationism, because we need the American empire. I forgot the exact words he used, but it's very close. You can find this at mondoweiss.net. We need the American empire available to protect Israel if necessary. So in other words, that's why we have to stay in NATO with Germany and Poland, right? It's just so that there is an American, you know, a powerful military establishment available to protect Israel, which is just not in the interests of anybody between, you know, Bangor and San Diego. It just has nothing to do with us.
Let me bring up a couple of highlights. Thing is, the whole thing is a highlight, but just things that stood out to me about this debate. Now, I felt like Crystal, as you kind of indicated before, wound up just speaking in generalities and platitudes. And there were, especially in that Q&A period, there were numerous times where you just started unloading facts and figures, exact numbers of deaths and perpetrated by whom and when and where and how, over and over and over again. It was a brutal, brutal beating. The comments all over social media, whether Twitter or the various video platforms or wherever, they were all saying, I just witnessed a murder. And here we were thinking that Scott Horton didn't believe in aggression. And this guy, he is flattening Bill Kristol. So the first thing was, after you guys had your opening
statement. I was going easy on him, Tom. I don't know what you're talking about.
If it had been full Scott Horton, yeah, it would have been even worse. But
Tell your audience. I asked Tom, hey, you know, what do you think of my thing? And you sent me some great corrections. I hope you noticed that I used quite a few of them there.
Thank you.
Especially with the numbering of the Iraq wars and all that, you know, great stuff. But Tom's recommendation to me was, no, beat him worse, you know, be meaner.
Bring that's right.
His name and roll more. And Peter Van Buren told me the same thing. He's a writer I really respect, and I had him look at it.
Him.
And he was like, no, man, you need to be more merciless on Crystol. You said this, you said this, you said this. And I was, man, you guys are meaner than me, I guess. I figured
I'd throw in notes.
Some kind of dry ones, you know, and but not, you know, fight the guy. I mean,
but my notes are like, you got to go
if
after this.
I was allowed to bring a knife, I would have just brought a knife, but, you know, TSA made me leave it.
No, I remember there were parts where I was saying, no, here what you need to say is, you know, blah, 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 blah. Like, you got to go after this blankety blank blank. You know, it's just full of obscenities. but
I feel the same way. You heard my rant just now for 10 minutes. I don't even know what you asked me anymore, but
yeah.
This is a little bit less contained me, I guess.
Yeah, right. I mean, on the Tom Woods show, you could be 100% Scott Horton.
Justin called Crystal the little Lenin of the neoconservative movement.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
So, yeah, and listen, everybody, just type in Raimondo neocons. This is what's so special about antiwar.com to me when, you know, the right around the time of the start of the war, you know, I guess in the year 2002, I started reading this stuff. And here I am thinking Republicans are Republicans and their most powerful leaders are people like James Baker III, right? This Sith Lord, you know, secret society, master, whatever thing. And Justin's like, no, it's the guys at the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs and the American Enterprise Institute and the Project for New American Century and the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. That's what you need to be looking at that you're not looking at. And there are all these names that aren't on your CFR lists because that ain't where it's at this year, buddy. You're in the past. And, you know, I was clued in right there. You know, I knew this guy, Raimondo. I don't know how he knows this stuff, but man, he knows this is what's really going on, which means that what I thought was going on is not what was going on.
All right. I love Justin Raimondo as much as anybody, but I need more Horton in this episode. So let me talk to you about what I specifically had in mind. So you guys give your opening statements, then you have your rebuttals. Your rebuttal was particularly good. And then Gene, the moderator, asked you a question. He asked, kind of following up on something Crystal had proposed. Okay, President Scott Horton, it's 9/11, and what do you propose we do? So then you went into your response to that. But then it just, all of a sudden, we moved to another dimension because you started in his presence. I mean, he was in that room and he heard what you said and it was directed right at him. The very kinds of things we had all wanted to say to him suddenly got said to him. Where you were saying that, you know, well, so what did these people do? Well, they said to themselves, oh, what a great opportunity. We had a bonus war. We'll tell people, oh, Saddam is going to give weapons to Osama, and those weapons are going to get your grandma, whatever, unless you let us go stop him and whatever. And so you exploited that fear and insecurity. You exploited that to go get your other war against, you know, what kind of guy? This Saddam Hussein of all people? And you just unloaded on him. So there was that. But then there were other times where Crystal would give you some platitude. The United States has kept the peace for 75 years. And you would say, well, why don't we go down the list of atrocities and mass murders that have been connived at or perpetrated by or assisted by the U.S. or its puppets? And then you went down and listed. And you said, now, look, it's true. Russia and Germany didn't go to war after 1945. But is it only white lives that matter? I mean, look at all these people in the East Timorese, and you just listed them all. And you said, I mean, millions of Vietnamese, millions of Koreans, but that's not all. And you just went on and on and on. How can you just sit here and talk in platitudes like that? It was just so masterful. And there were viewing parties around the country, by the way. Our friend, I shouldn't say names because they're private individuals, but some mutual friends of ours had viewing parties where people were cheering for Scott Horton. And now Caitlin Johnstone, who's a great lefty, posted the video, and all her people are saying, this Scott Horton is unbelievable. I mean, you really were a great representative for us. I mean, that wasn't primarily what you were doing, but it was a nice side effect of what you were doing.
Well, cool. Thank you, man. I mean, I'm a lot more nervous when I go on the Kennedy show than I was for this. And I probably maybe just because I had written out my statement and rehearsed it a couple times, whatever, but I pretty much felt at ease. The only thing I was afraid, I mean, in terms of like, am I going to be able to deal with this idiot? You know, that should be fine.
Yeah.
But the thing I was afraid of was that, you know, whatever I did wouldn't be, you know, that in some way would let y'all down. Like, well, it was okay. You know, I don't know. Good old Horton, he did pretty good. You know, if it was like that, that would have been a real letdown.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that you guys, you know, took it as the beating that you were hoping for.
Yes. You know? I mean, look, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, so I understand you would build up your own set of expectations for it.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, I actually saw where Jeff Deist got mad at me on Twitter and said, you know, Horton's framing this all wrong about liberalism and all of this. But, like, all I was doing was attacking the neocon from the neocon. You know, I wasn't exactly saying...
Yeah, I know what you were... I know
his presumptions of American centrist liberalism are anywhere near mine. I guess what I was really trying to say, oh, and I guess I did say late. I bet Jeff tweeted that earlier on. Later on, I said, part of the problem at Dave was that the neoconservatives and their neoliberal counterparts never understood what liberty was about in the first place. Right? In other words, you know, George W. Bush, Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, post-Cold War modern liberalism shouldn't exist. It should have been kicked out of the way and replaced by libertarianism a long time ago. Because we're not left or right. We're good on everything. And we understand what liberty is about. It's the unified field theory of human nature, man. It's badass. Everybody should learn about it. And instead, we've had like these imposters, right? These neoliberals who, well, they're not socialists. And they're not really, you know, they're, in fact, if anything, they're like quasi-fascist in a way, depending on exactly how you define it. It's a participatory fascism, as Robert Higgs says, but it's something like that, you know? And
yeah.
So, you know, Bill Clinton, I remember in the 90s, would say, listen, we're spreading free markets and democracy to the world. And that is what they're doing in their own mind, but self-government and capitalism in the way that we understand it is a completely alien concept to them. You know, they really are a lot closer to fascists, but they call it liberalism. And it ends up, and in fact, as you heard him express over and over, it's the greatest kind of wallpaper for this house of horrors. You know, that look, I mean, America's great. We've got these great statues and the big marble buildings and regular elections. And look, the average schmuck can make a living in America, can own a business and keep his money a lot more than a lot of places. A lot of people have very good lives here, no doubt about it. And then that becomes the excuse for then we can do anything we want. That's what, we're so exceptional. We're so free that that means then ethics and morality and the law doesn't apply to us. We can commit any crime and any sin and get away with it because of the Statue of Liberty or something like that. I don't know. And that was why I'm glad I had the opportunity to bring up Harry Brown, because he did have a killer Statue of Liberty speech. And it was about how the world sucks out there. What do you think we're all doing here? Our ancestors fled the old world because it's horrible. Not all of it, but you know what I mean. People came here for a better life. And so, yeah, there's plenty of improvements that could be made. We could do a whole lot of shows about all the problems with the rest of the world. But what right do we have to criticize these countries when our violence is the worst thing going on in them? It's just this insane, you know? The whole thing is just, it does feel like in Back to the Future 2, where Doc Brown is like, look, Marty, things got all screwed up and it was skewed to a tangent to this alternative timeline where everything is just stupid and wrong. And it's just not supposed to be this way.
Hey, everybody, let's thank our sponsor, Skillshare. You know how old Woods here is always saying that the Tom Woods Show improves your life in multiple ways, not just intellectually, but in a multitude of ways? Here's a great example. Skillshare is an online learning community that offers thousands of inspiring classes for creative and curious people like you folks on topics including illustration, design, photography, video, freelancing, and more. It's for beginners. It's for experts. It's for people who'd like to expand their horizons and get out of their comfort zone and do something new and exciting. And it's for skilled people who want to get even better at what they're already doing. These classes are concise and to the point, so they fit your schedule, and you don't have to put your life on hold to do them. I've told you about the marketing and entrepreneurship classes that I've taken, but my daughters, too, have taken Skillshare classes in everything from American Sign Language to fiction writing, and even just something as fun and silly as doodling. Well, explore your creativity at Skillshare.com/woods and get a one-month free trial of premium membership. That's a one-month free trial of Skillshare premium membership at Skillshare.com/woods. Let me say something quickly about the debate format, though, before I forget. It's an Oxford-style debate, which means that there's an objective winner at the end. They poll the audience at the beginning, and they ask, where do you stand on the resolution, in favor, against, or undecided? Then after the debate, audience is polled again, and then whoever has moved more votes in his direction is declared the winner. So I was afraid for you, for probably the same reason you might have been concerned, that maybe the whole room already agrees with you. So there's nowhere to go but down.
Right.
So you have to hold that entire large majority that you have, plus add more to it. That's really hard. So it turns out you started off with the support of 75% in the room, which was hard. No, I beg your pardon, 72%. Yeah. So that's really, really hard to do. And you wound up going up to 85% by the time the thing was done.
That's pretty good. Although I gotta be honest, like, it occurs to me that some of those people might have just voted undecided at the beginning so they could have their mind changed, you know, but they're my people probably, you know, I don't know. Who comes undecided to a war between antiwar.com and the Weekly Standard, you know?
Yeah, I know. But on the other hand, maybe people brought their friends, you know, their friends who don't know anything.
Oh, that's true. In fact, yeah. You know, one guy told me that the lady behind him was on a date, but she got stood up and she didn't even know why she was there or who either of these goofballs are. And so he explained to her, well, that's the bad guy and that's our guy. And so they're going to fight about the wars. Just sit back and watch. You don't want to leave. Go ahead and stay and check it out. And he said she did and had a great time. And I forgot what
great.
He said about, I'm pretty sure that she liked me at the end, not him.
That's good. That's good. The other thing about the Oxford style, I didn't know this till after I did one. I did a debate with Michael Malice on the legacy of Alexander Hamilton. And I found out only at the end that apparently it violates at least the spirit of the Oxford style to go into the closing statement and do anything other than sum up what's been said so far. If you introduce new material at the end that the other person can't rebut, that's considered not right. And that's exactly what I did. I said, oh, by the way, let me mention this, this, and this. Thankfully, Malice didn't realize that that was breaking the rules. Well, that was also, I saw a little bit of that with Scott Horton, but again, nobody knows that. And I think even Gene said
that.
Yeah, now apparently you're not supposed to do that. But yeah. No, but Scott, let me tell you. This
I wouldn't
exactly
have broken the rules if I knew that was the
I know, I know, I know. But on the other hand, I wanted a Scott Horton closing statement where you get up and say, oh, listen, I just need to add, like, there's some more horrible things you people need to know that I didn't get to before. That was such a classic Scott Horton closing that I'm just glad it happened that way.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I'm glad that I had time to talk about that. And I'm really glad I had time to mention the poor Somalis. I got to tell you, man, it just, in all the terror war coverage, even of all the people who are interested in it, just for some reason, nobody cares about that war. And, you know, maybe it's a little bit hard to understand, but not really, that at two different times, in the early 2010s and then in the like around 2017, they had these massive droughts in East Africa. But then in Somalia, they were at war. So they didn't just have a drought, they had a famine. But the war was caused by George Bush and Barack Obama. And they could have stopped, and they didn't. They wouldn't stop. And so people died, you know, in the early, just, this is from the government statistics, the American government-sponsored foundation, FuseNet statistics from 2013, was that 250,000 people had starved to death, which means, the children under 5 years old lay down and die. And nobody cares about this, and they never talk about this. And in fact, I know everybody, here's your hook. I should have used this hook. Remember the giant locust infestation from last year in East Africa? It was cool because they finally figured out what causes locusts when grasshoppers are so close together that their back legs rub against each other. They turn into locusts. There's a huge plague across East Africa. And of course, hit Somalia the worst because they're at war. And you know where they came from? They came from Yemen. And in Yemen, at the university there in Sana'a, they used to have this big program of going out and massacring grasshoppers and keeping their populations in check just for this reason, just to keep them from ever becoming locusts. And you can't do anything with them. You just kill them, I guess. I think they eat them. But because of America's war in Yemen, Tom, the university, I don't know if the Saudis bombed it or not, but you know, they were not open for business and their grasshopper infestation eradication efforts were halted. And the grasshoppers turned into locusts and decimated crops throughout East Africa. And, you know, I don't know, who knows the excess death rate from that? But it's America's fault. What can you say, man? I'm from here. It's just true.
Yeah, and when we say that, I think so many people have absorbed the idea that they are America and the government is America and they are the government. So anybody insulting the government is insulting them. That's just the way the regime likes it. You know, so that if you take personal offense when somebody attacks your overlords, that's just the way they like it. So that you'll get all indignant and make excuses for them and whatever. And you got to just break out of that. I used to do that when I was a dumb kid. And I just thought, well, I love America. So I got to stand up for what? What do I have to stand up for? The military industrial complex? Some stupid press release from the Pentagon that's full of lies? And why is the Pentagon the one part of the U.S. government that's just always telling me the truth? Why would that be?
They have the highest approval ratings of any institution in America, above and beyond any religious institution or any social institution or any other form of government in the country anywhere.
Yeah.
No matter how many wars they start and lose.
Yeah. I know. That must be nice to be in that position. Nothing matters.
Yeah. Hey, wave the flag, man. I can't believe you hate America, Tom. Talk your way out of that hole. And you know, see, I think it's worn off a little bit. People don't remember the pressure of the Bush years, how it was like that in the Bush years. Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity were omnipresent, shouting down anyone who would dare to contradict this narrative. For years, it was like that. It wasn't until, I'd like to remind people of this, because I think a lot of people didn't notice this the way I, you know, figured this at the time. And in fact, I was at Ron Paul's birthday party in 2005 down there. In Galveston, I guess, or Texas, right around there. And I was on my way home, and I was in the very tail arm of Hurricane Katrina on the way home in my little pickup truck and in that storm. And man, what a storm. And that storm drowned New Orleans. And George Bush sat there and did nothing for 6 solid days. And America was like, what in the hell is going on around here? The Louisiana National Guard is in Iraq getting their legs blown off. You know, fighting for who again? Yeah. And no one is here to help. And the Army and the Navy aren't doing anything. And the only thing the police are doing is turning back private actors who are trying to help. Walmart comes with bottles of water and they turn them away. And the Alabama Flat Bottom Aluminum Bass Boat Fishermen Association came with all their boats to go out rescuing people in their boats that sit a couple inches in the water and could go anywhere. Right? And nope. At gunpoint, you better get the hell out of here instead of helping rescue anyone. And then more than 1,000 people drowned. Anyway, not just that, but the point is that was finally when faith in W. Bush was broken, at least in the TV narrative, where, Anderson Cooper is crying. Now, all of a sudden, maybe George W. Bush and his team are not the world history's most competent administrators who we all must defer to a few days ago in every case, including torturing people to death and starting wars based on lies. And then finally, when they did a little mini Iraq in Louisiana, people were like, damn, man. Who are these guys and why are they in charge of us? And it's too bad that the lesson didn't stick, that just like in the 1990s, the narrative became the government isn't that bad. It's just Bill Clinton that's bad. So then faith in Bush was broken, but faith in the state was not. So let's move on to the next one. But man, I mean, I really am curious. Maybe with the technologies, Tom, we'll live enough to see. What's the long enough to see? What will be the history of this era as written 100 years from now? I mean, assuming there's free access to information for historians to even try to figure it out. Like, what are they going to say about this? W. Bush and Barack Obama and Donald Trump. Man, what an era. And by the way, Donald Trump, despite all his talk, escalated the war in Afghanistan vastly. He dropped as many bombs on Afghanistan in 4 years or nearly as Obama did in 8, including the surge. Killed tens of thousands of innocent people over there for some macho BS posturing. He didn't care about that war. He was against that war all along. And he escalated it anyway. And he participated full stop for 4 years straight in having the USA back the war in Yemen, which is absolutely the worst thing going on in the world right now and is as bad as Iraq War II. Absolute atrocity. And the war in Somalia, he complained, why are we even in Somalia? Madison, you have no choice. He said, okay, escalate. Send more Rangers, even infantry, more drones. You know, people say he ended the war in Syria, but that's just because the war in Syria was ending when he was inaugurated. You know, Obama had already built the caliphate and destroyed it. Donald Trump was just there for the mopping up exercise at that point. So,
well, incidentally, that actually reminds me of a moment in the debate because Syria came up.
I'm sorry, Tom. Let me correct myself there. That's not really true. Donald Trump was there in charge of some very bitter fighting in 2017. The war wasn't really over until the end of 2017, and very big battles for Mosul and Raqqa took place under his term. So I shouldn't play that down.
No, that's okay. That's okay. What I was thinking about was the moment, and again, people should just watch it for themselves. Obviously, I'll have the video linked on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1987. You should go watch it. But there was a time when it was like Ron Paul talking to Rudy Giuliani. Look, this is what you need to read. You know, I don't understand why you don't know this. But then also with regard to Syria specifically, that's why I thought of it. He was talking about Obama taking a totally hands-off position on it. And you just couldn't believe he wasn't aware that, look, no, we have the black ops budget and we know that Obama was spending $1 billion a year and you just went... I don't know why you don't know this, but it was just great to speak to Bill Kristol that way. No one talks to him that way. Nobody talks to him like that. And this was polite Scott Horton. This was,
and you know what, Tom? Yeah. I have to say, when he said, oh, I don't believe that they were motivated on 9/11 to attack us because of anything that America had done, I kind of think that he meant that because he could have just said nothing at that point. The way that that came out actually seemed honest to me. Like, he never knew that the Giuliani moment happened. Or if he did, he only had, remember, the establishment's initial take was that Giuliani had crushed Paul. Because what the hell do they know? So if he knew anything about that, that's probably his recollection of that. And I bet you he didn't know that Ron Paul said, no, you have to read Robert Pape and all this stuff. And I really think he doesn't know the first thing about it. It's not in his interest to know anything about it. He really is a lightweight, isn't he? Really just talking, I kept the peace for 75 years and there hadn't been a nuclear war and... I don't know. I feel like I think that maybe I believe and disagree and thing and just, but he didn't really.
Yeah, no,
he didn't really want to talk about Iraq War II. He got a real
detail. But what I loved, Scott, was you in the Q&A would give some highly detailed answer. And then Gene would say, Bill, would you like to rebut that? And most of the time, he just declined. Well, because of course he doesn't want to rebut it. There's no way. He's realizing, wait a minute, I didn't know anything about this Horton. I should have looked into him. He's realizing there's no way I can go up against this guy. So no, thank you. I don't need to rebut. Even though you just defecated all over his position, you would think he'd want to rebut that. but he does not have that command of the information. There's no question about that after watching that.
And I think it's the tactic too is, I guess, I don't know if this would work, but I guess for people on his side, that they would see him as just being totally superior to me and aloof to my petty arguments and just, I don't need to rebut that because it's just not that substantive, I don't think, or something, you know, something like that. But
that would
right, though, that they were substantive. So I don't know.
Yes, right. So, but that would be a posture he would adopt to seem sophisticated, or constantly be writing notes so that it, you know, looks like, well, I'm going to rebut this by the following arguments. But I'd love to see what exactly he was writing. I mean, you know, it could have just been, got to pick up some milk later. You know, I mean, because I don't think he had anything prepared most of the time.
I think later on he stopped writing notes. I think at first, when I first started, he was like writing down, I assume that he was like writing down topics that I was bringing up.
For the rebuttal.
He would like go try to go back and address later. But then I think at some point in the original opening statement, I crammed a lot in that 17 minutes. And it was all about, you know, he had made the right that much worse and how horrible all of the wars were in 20 years. He couldn't address those things. I didn't make the right worse. I didn't tell anybody to hate Muslims. I didn't tell them that there were sleeper cells all over America going to kill their mama and all that. I don't know what you're talking about. Like, people remember, you know. So what's he going to say? All he could say was like, look, there have been some mistakes. And that's what they all would say. Yeah, you know what? Sometimes these things don't work out like we want, but you got to try and do what you can. And what are you going to do? Not try? That's what Hillary Clinton's friend Anne Marie Slaughter said. She said, look, Hillary Clinton would rather be caught trying than doing nothing. You know, even if it doesn't work out, at least she gave it a shot. Meaning started a war in Libya, right? Like, you know, invaded a country because the alternative was doing nothing. The alternative, Tom, was not invading a country.
Yeah.
It's unthinkable.
And every single disaster. So whether it's the financial crisis of 2008, well, we got to bail everybody out. We can't let these financial firms not give out bonuses this Christmas. I mean, we got to bail them out. Otherwise, we'd be doing nothing. And it's just constant. It's the COVID or whatever. It's they can't ever do nothing. And by the way, them doing nothing doesn't mean no one else does something. I mean, I would, if the economy had just been left alone after 2008, it's not like nobody would have done anything. It's that entrepreneurs would have figured out what makes sense to do from now on. People would have done things, just not politicians. But they have to be the ones, quote, doing something. And it's always a disaster, like time after time after time. But they have this intellectual class of the universities and the media that somehow, you know, makes their mistakes is too polite. Their catastrophes sound sort of okay and well-intentioned and with a silver lining. And so it's a really good racket they have going if they're dealing entirely with unimaginative people who can't think original thoughts. And unfortunately, we're surrounded by a lot of those.
Yeah. Well, and especially when people are afraid, you know, or if not afraid, very concerned about some terrible atrocity happening somewhere that we could help and do something. Can you imagine if we didn't help the people and we have all this power? You think Superman should just stay home? He should just be a businessman and not use his power to save the world? Come on. But again, you have to just ignore all the bodies of innocent civilians and just pretend, you know, live in this comic book world where everything is as general as those arguments and where, you know, you never have to cash the checks in and make sure, you know, and have accountability for what actually happens to people. So, you know, I'm sure I haven't read all these Mises books. I know I was supposed to, but I think he's got one on the economics of bureaucracy and
yeah.
And how all that works. And I'm sure there's a lot of great analysis along those lines where just, you got to do it that way or else you'd have to stop. And you can't stop. So you just BS people, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course you got to lie. It'd be like if we were talking about the Jersey mob. You know what, Tom? The Jersey mob, some of those guys lie, you know? Yeah. Well, sometimes, yes, they have to engage in dishonesty in the course of their business, stealing and killing people, you know?
Yeah, it's...
Otherwise, it'd be more difficult for them to get away with the things that they're getting away with.
The website I want you guys to check out, by the way, after you watch the video at tomwoods.com/1987. I mean, there are multiple websites. I could send you to libertarianinstitute.org. I could send you to scotthorton.org. I could send you to antiwar.com. But I guess any of those, you're in one way or another supporting Scott because he's got a hand in all of them. But Scott really is one of these people. I don't just have him on and say, hey, Scott Horton's a great guy. Thanks for being here. I say to people, support Scott Horton, because what this was a David and Goliath situation, you know, where you have this media darling who is known by everybody and friends with everybody and moves very easily among the elites. And then you have one of us. You have Scott Horton, who is one of us. And he went there and completely outclassed the guy. This is exactly why none of the elites will ever, ever face us face to face. It's not because we're not respectable and they won't dignify us. It's because they would get steamrolled, which is exactly what happened here. So I want you to watch the video and, I mean, literally make popcorn. Make some popcorn and sit with a loved one, and it'll be a wonderful evening of free entertainment at tomwoods.com/1987. But then go over to Scott's website, scotthorton.org, and as a thank you for doing that for you and for us and for the world and for the cause of peace, you know, send a few smackers over to Scott. Scott, thank you for coming on right after you did this debate. I appreciate it a lot, and congratulations to you for winning.
Thank you very much, Tom. Appreciate it, buddy.
All right, everybody, that's going to do it for today. Go watch Scott's debate. You're going to love it so much. You're going to love it so much. It will eventually come out as part of the Soho Forum podcast, where they have in podcast form all the debates that they feature over time. And so Scott's will appear there, and you'd be able to get an audio version that you could listen to in the car. So that'll be coming if you subscribe to that podcast. Otherwise, if you'd like to see the video, as I say, I'll have it at tomwoods.com/1987. All right, tomorrow we're going to go from theory to practice. We have a lot of theory out there about the business cycle and boom and bust and what causes it, all that. And we're great on that. But what should businesses do? If you say to them, well, here's the Austrian theory of the business cycle, what are they supposed to do with that information? Well, it turns out there are a lot of very specific courses of action they can take if they know this information. So we actually do have practical information to offer the world. How about that? So we're going to talk about that with our old friend Murray Sabrin tomorrow. So remember, folks, if you are listening to The Tom Woods Show on YouTube, remember that my most controversial episodes are just not going to be on YouTube anymore. So I would strongly urge you to check out the show on Odyssey, Odysee. I have my Odyssey channel at tomwoods.com/vid, V-I-D, tomwoods.com/vid. And that's how you can make sure, if you are one of my YouTube listeners, that you're not missing any episodes. You'll know you're missing an episode if there's a gap in between the numbers on my YouTube channel. That means I decided not to put that episode on YouTube. So check out all my episodes, the censored ones and the available ones on YouTube, all together collected in order over at tomwoods.com/vid. All right, see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of The Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.